Welcome to episode number 39 of the podcast More Than Tones, Music Education and Society. This is the second of two episodes that were produced by Juan Esteban Rendon and Juliana Otto, both students at the University of the Arts Berlin. I'm very happy to present the second part of their conversation with Joseph Abramo, who is an associate professor of music education at the University of Connecticut. They continue talking about the ideas of the Brazilian educator and philosopher Paulo Freire and focus on those philosophical ideas that can be translated into practice in music classrooms today.
Acorda, amor. Eu tive pesadelo agora. Sonhei que tinha gente lá fora batendo no portão. Que aflição era dura numa muito escura viatura. Minha nossa santa criatura, chame, 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 chame ladrão, chame ladrão, acorda amor.
So, of course, Freire wrote this book, Pedagogy of the Oppressed, in another time, in another context. It was South America in the 60s. So we're talking about oppression and dictatorship, right? And when he describes his pedagogy and his literacy methods, basically he's talking about liberating people, and more exactly, the liberation of the poor. So I think it will be really interesting, especially for music teachers who will be hearing this podcast, to know, okay, how can we begin to translate this liberation of the poor pedagogy into something that we can put in practice in the music classroom?
Right, absolutely. I think that this is one of the fundamental problems, and I mean problem in a good way, problem in the way that Freire talks about problems. It is one of the fundamental problems of this text, which is when we in countries where the oppression is very, very different and talking about something like music education, can we take this text too far? Are we exploiting this text? Are we using it in ways that perhaps is not true to the spirit of it, right? So I often talk to my students, and I think I ended that first video with asking, well, who is the oppressed?
Dr. Abramo refers to one of his videos about Pedagogy of the Oppressed that you can find on his YouTube channel. Link in the description.
I think for Freire, the answer was very, very clear, right? He was working with workers, illiterate people who, by governmental policies, by corporations, was keeping these people very, very downtrodden. And when we're talking about students who still might have very oppressed aspects of them, the very idea that they're sitting in a classroom and they're playing an instrument or learning about music, I think to a certain degree does separate them from who Freire was talking about. And so that's not to say that we just dismiss the text at all, but I think we have to be very sensitive to those dynamics. So that's something that I continually think about and talk to the students about is, you know, who's this text about and how do we use it? I think for music teachers, you know, the things that immediately come to mind is the ways that we bank and we do anti-dialogical education, right? I mean, banking is such a big part of music education. Like just this idea that I'm going to give you the scale, I'm going to give you the dates of Bach, I'm going to give you all these things and you're going to, you know, you're going to get deposited with them. And we're not going to talk about it because I know the dates of Bach. I know this B-flat scale. You need to know them now too. And that so much of music education is structured around those two ideas that for me, that's such an important part of that text.
Yeah, I think this brings us naturally to go deeper into that because while reading Freire, and this opposition between banking education and problem-posing education, I was confronted with the idea of tradition in music especially, and on a broader scale, culture. So I find this really interesting to talk a little bit about liberty in music and in music classrooms, for example, too. But especially, how could we maintain or pass on tradition without being oppressive? And in the broader sense, I did actually ask myself if the act of passing all culture is in the end an act of imposition of, or what's behind all that?
Yeah, I think a lot of people have a lot of different views on this. To start with, the most, I would say, radical way of approaching this is to say, yeah, to a certain degree, the passing on of this culture is a continuation of oppressed, oppressor situations. So in a certain degree, from this viewpoint, it could be that the fact that we're passing on, I'm sorry, I keep bringing up German composers, I have to apologize, but Bach and Mozart and
I mean, that's our tradition, right?
Yeah, well, they're the pantheon, right? They're the German tradition sits, as we all know, sits on top of the top, right? It is the hierarchy, and then just below that are the French, and then come the Italians and everyone else, right? that tends to be the kind of simple-minded hierarchy that we do have in classical music. And I mean, that's a great example right there in itself, right? This idea that when we talk about traditions, if we don't interrogate those sorts of questions about why, for example, is Germanic 19th century and a little bit 18th century Germanic music held up as the prototype, the most pure of the purest music, which is classical music. If we don't continue to interrogate that, if we just pass that on, if we just bank that, then we're continuing the oppression, right? The oppression being, of course, that anyone who doesn't fall into that sort of pattern is considered lesser. But in addition to that, all we have to do is step outside classical music and start saying, well, what about other traditions? You know, are they not as good? So that's like the most, I think, radical reading of it. You know, like I told you, I was rereading it for before now, and one of the things that leaped out to me more than it has in the past is towards the end of the book where he talks about this concept of cultural synthesis, right? And towards the end of the book, he's much more careful to start saying, well, you know, I'm talking about dialogue here, but what is the role of the educator, of the leader in this context? Can they add anything to this? And his answer is, well, yes, right? It's about this sort of cultural synthesis. It's this coming together. The teacher is not simply another student, although he's very clear in trying to say that sort of thing. But he's saying the teacher does have something to bring here, does have some expertise to bring into this. And if done in a way that it is continues to be dialogical, is of value. I think that that's the much more reasonable approach because if you think about something like music, right, which I don't think is horribly violent, not like, again, what Freire was talking about. You know, Bach, for example, has sustained me in my life. He's someone who I continually come back to and listen to. I personally don't believe that it is violent to teach students about Bach. Is it violent to say that he is the best of the best and that every other music is awful compared to him? Yes, I do think it's that. But I do like to think that we as educators can draw upon the traditions that we do have and introduce them in a way that is dialogical, that is healthy, that is problem-posing, that is nonviolent. So I see that as the sort of more tempered way to approach this. And I do think that there's aspects in the text that tell us that that is a way forward.
Juan and I talked a lot about how to play music freely. That means decide freely about how we or students want to play it. We wondered how much instruction would be not too much because the students should know something to make a decision properly, but also be free about it. And there are also music history and music theory. How can we teach that without performing banking education?
Yeah, so I hear two things in there. One is first about, again, is sort of an expansion on the idea of tradition here, right? The idea of like, how do we teach music theory and how do we teach history? So in that particular case, at least in the United States, music theory is very, very, as a very banking system, right? Where it's like, these are intervals. There's a major third and a minor third, right? And now here are the chords, and you just fill the student as a receptacle with this information, and they're supposed to kind of just spit it back out. That approach is very problematic. I think from a history standpoint, you know, Freire talks about myths, but then when we think about the biographies of composers, so much of those tend to be myths too, right? So there's that famous story of Mozart at the age of, I think it was like 14 or 15, mid-teenage years, he went to the Vatican and he heard the Miserere by Allegri, and he was able to write it down on one reading, right? So if you look at any sort of research, that's probably not true. He probably did, in fact, write it down, but they think he probably had access to a score. He had heard it a couple of times, that sort of stuff, right? And so we as education people can't take these stories, these biographies of composers as facts, because they play these ideological roles. So again, you can't bank those things. What I think that all tells us is that the opposite of banking is this problem posing. And what that essentially is that it's not about telling people up front, but letting them explore and then telling them after. So this is a little different from Freire, but I think it's so relevant to what is his sort of theory in part. Is I always tell my students this particular study that happened where they took this really interesting toy for toddlers, right? Like 2 to 3 year olds. And it had all these interesting things in it where you would press buttons and music would come out. It had a mirror in it. You could press this button and like these things happen. Okay. So they took this toy and they did an experiment. They put the toy down, and for one group of kids, they would bring a kid in and the teacher would say, look, I'm going to press this button. Notice how the sound comes out, right? Okay, I'm going to do this. And then they said, go play with it, all right? With another group, they brought the kid in, they put the toy down, and the teacher like would press buttons and act surprised and be like, oh my goodness, I can't believe that sound happened. And what is that? And they found that for the first group where they were showed, you know, this is, you press this button like this and you do this, the kids didn't play with it for a very long time. They kind of looked at it a little bit. They pressed a couple of buttons. They weren't terribly interested. They crawled away. With the kids where the adult was surprised, they played for a lot longer and they played in ways that were much more inventive. And for me, I think that this is a lot of what Freire is talking about. I think he's way more political than what we just talked about. But I think at the heart is that very idea, which is like the teacher actually came in and said, in some sort of weird way, let's have a dialogue about this weird toy. I don't know everything about it. I'm not going to bank the information of this toy on you. I'm going to discover and dialogue about this toy with you. And when you do that, the kid has a different sort of engagement with that object. And so that's the way that I always think about these things with music. This is how I always taught triads. I said to my students, you know, I could have shown up and said, okay, in music theory, we have this thing called the triad. There are major triads, there are minor triads, there are these. Instead, this is the way I always did it. I said, we've got pianos here. All I want you to do is go to the instruments and play 3 notes. Sometimes I would do more, I'd just say any notes, but play 3 notes that sound pleasant together. And let's just write them down. The students write them down. We put them on a board and then we start saying, do you see any patterns here? At that point, they might know about intervals. And so we say, oh, some of them have a major third, then a minor third. Some of them have a minor third, then a major third. And you say, well, we've got categories for these sorts of things. They're called major chords and minor chords and those sorts of things. So I think that, you know, ultimately that's what dialogue is about, is this idea of not coming and saying, here's the information and just giving it to people, but saying, let's discover it together. Even when the teacher has to fake that discovery, right? What I mean by fake the discovery is like, yeah, the teacher knows what's going to happen. Teacher is not discovering triads for the first time. They know what they are. But
when he presses the button, you mean?
Yeah, exactly.
For the 20th time in the day.
Yes, right.
I think it's also, you also need to be brave to follow this way of education because you don't know where it ends. So you can't really follow your plan of things that the students find out. So maybe they will say that they think a seventh sounds more harmonic than a third. And you can't tell them, no, this sounds much better.
Right. Yeah. And that's, yes. And that's where the art of teaching comes in, where, you know, yes, they might say that, but then you can steer them in another direction and say, well, but yeah, that's true, but let's focus on this for a minute.
So we read this report of German music teacher who visited 5 different secondary schools in the USA. And one of the key differences they found is that at least in these schools they visited, these students had the choice of learning music. While in Germany, every kid who goes to school has to have music lessons, which is also a problem. Juliana was telling me that it's also a problem because there's not enough music teachers in Germany. And then I connected this thought with a topic which is discussed really often in the classical music world, and is how are we going to build the audience of the future, right? So there's a lot of discussions going on how to kind of put classical music inside the heads of the new generations so that they can grow to be part of the market. So that like kind of connected with the passing on tradition thing that we were discussing, right? This report talked about like how it was really easier in the USA to work with students because they chose to be there. So would you say music class shouldn't be obligatory? What's your take on that?
Yeah, so I think I'd be curious to see that study. I can't speak to Germany, for example. I actually don't know much about music education there. But in the United States, we tend to have a little bit of obligatory education and then lots of electives. Basically, what it comes down to is that 85% of the students don't elect to do those electives, right? So the vast majority of them don't participate in it. And I think that that structures so much of our conversation in the US because we're continually interested in thinking about the ways that that privileges some students and not others. And so what we wind up having is we have ensembles on one side, band, chorus, and orchestra. And then on the other side, we have what we call general music. And general music tends to be that obligatory kind of compulsory courses, and they're seen as somewhat inferior. For me personally, I started out as an ensemble director in bands. Like I said, I played saxophone. But by the end of my career, I just absolutely loved general music because it was so much more of a flexible space. You know, you could do all sorts of things that you can't do in a band. So I think everybody should have access to music education. One of the things we always talk about is the ones who continue on, the reason they do that is because of systemic issues, right? They can afford the instruments, they could afford private lessons, they're in school districts that will provide the money for them to do that. So saying to a kid, well, you've decided that you really don't want to do music, it's not your thing, that's not a personal choice, right? That's a choice that's been made for them in part because of structures. I'm kind of dancing around your answer, but I think the short answer then is yeah, I do believe in obligatory music education. Yeah.
I think it's also a difficult question because it really, really depends on the lessons and on the teacher. So I think it will be my task in an elementary school to show every student that there's a kind of music that they have access to and that they like. So maybe there will be some students that won't like classical music at all, or they won't like Mozart or Beethoven, but this is okay. So maybe we have an access on rap music or on Latin music with them. So I believe that everybody is touched by music and you cannot decide about something you don't know. So if children decide to do not go to music lessons, they don't know what they miss because they can't decide about it yet.
That's right. I love how you said it, right? Like, you can't make a decision about what you don't know about. And so that's why we should have them experience all these different things. Yeah, absolutely.
Let us now take a look into the future. I think Freire addresses a lot of questions and concepts that were already there beforehand and that will be part of the conversation in the future, like humanization, liberation, dialogue. So in that sense, Pedagogy of the Oppressed will always have this freshness and relevance, if you wish. But a lot has happened since the 60s. It is another time now. So do you think Freire is the impulse a revolution in education needs today? Or do you think we need another kind of impulse?
Yeah, great question. And this is something, again, that leapt out to me this last time that I read it. A couple of things on this. One is it is a product of its time. It is very much an old school form of Marxism. And I think that there are a couple of mistakes that are embedded within the text that we in today's society need to really address. So as the text talks, it seems to talk about coming to consciousness, coming to understanding objective reality. He hedges a little bit on this. Sometimes he goes back and forth. But there is largely this idea that there is this oppressive ideology, and if people just simply think and engage in praxis, it'll turn into a kind of utopian society. And I think he fails to realize, like many of the old school Marxists, that the system that is going to replace it could be just as bad. And I think that this is the story of many communist states in many ways, right? And he talks about how, well, the leaders need to continually be in dialogue with the people. And I think the problem is if we had someone as smart as Lenin, as someone as smart as Mao, and they weren't able to do it in a genuine way, they became oppressive in their own ways. What chance does everyone else to kind of create these systems? So I think that those are some inherent problems in this text that people need to think about. What I do think it needs us to do is actually double down on what he talks about with dialogue and understand that any system that is put in place has the potential to be oppressive. I think he's ultimately saying that in this text. I think the way that he writes about it through the, you know, Marxist tradition of this idea of like revolution is this thing that happens and then we're in this utopian society, I think that's a little too boxy for me, you know. Instead, I like actually the ways that post-structuralists and postmodernists talk about this, which is the idea that you're just moving into these different spaces, these different ideologies, and each one of them has potential. None of them is utopian. And it's you have to choose carefully among these ideologies rather than this idea of oppressive ideology. Get rid of it, and then we'll all live freer. And so maybe ultimately that means using lots of different things and putting them together. You know, for example, I'm thinking Estelle Jorgensen writes about that with her, which she calls her dialectical method, this idea of just borrowing from different places and putting them together. Maybe that's the answer to it. In some sense, again, I think it does somewhat go back to the text in that I think dialogue and problems are ultimately what this text is about. And I do think that those are sort of the solutions. I suppose the mindset that we should have is that revolution isn't a day, isn't a clear mark in the sand, right? It isn't the day of revolution comes. It's more evolution than revolution, right? It is always a system of tinkering towards something rather than this idea of let's bring students to consciousness. They have realized the oppression that they're in, and now they're going to act properly. I think that that is a lifelong, slow, not obvious process that happens.
Yeah, really interesting. Well, thank you very much. This was awesome.
Yeah, this has been a pleasure.
I enjoyed it a lot.
Thank you for inviting me. It's been such a pleasure talking to you too.
Thank you so much. Goodbye.
This was episode number 39 of the podcast More Than Tones, Music Education and Society. I want to thank Juan Esteban Rendon, Juliana Otto and Joseph Abramo for their contributions to this podcast series. In these difficult times of homeschooling and working from our homes, it's nice to get some feedback and get to know other people's thoughts about the topics we talk about. That's why we invite you to comment on this episode on Facebook or on the blog www.mehralstone.de. On this website, you will also find a space for your comments, ideas, and suggestions. The upcoming episode will be in German again. It will be a conversation with the German sociologist Martin Seliger, who is an expert in German gangster rap and its social preconditions in Germany. I'm sure that there will be more episodes in English in the future, so stay tuned and in the meantime, enjoy making music, listening to music, and teaching.